Welcome to the Linux Lugcast. We are an open podcast slash lug that meets at 9 p.m. Eastern every first and third Friday of the month using Mumble. If you'd like to join us, please visit linuxlugcast.com for the server details. We also have a Mumble how-to on the site explaining exactly how to configure Mumble. Then you just join us on the Linux Lugcast room. During the live show, during the live show, if you're unable to join us in Mumble, you can listen to us streaming live. You can also join us on IRC on Freenode on the Linux Lugcast channel. If you have any questions, comments, or topics you would like us to discuss, please email us at feedback@linuxlugcast.com. We also have a Google Plus community site and a mailing list. Just visit our website for the direct links to all of those things. All right, I am your host tonight. I'm Fweeb. And tonight with us, we have 5150.
Howdy, folks.
Honky Magoo.
Evening.
And Netminer. Hello. And we had a little feedback over the break about the podcast, about setting up Google Sheets in WordPress, which would be helpful, but we haven't made any progress on showing the actual, putting that on the site yet, have we?
No, I have not. Sorry.
Well, I mean, you were just proclaiming your laziness, so we can't really call you out on that at this point.
Yes, I am.
Cool. Well, and beyond that, we didn't have much in the way of listener feedback. So, 50, you want to get right on into it? I think your levels are a little soft too. Just to let you know.
Okay. How about now?
Rocking.
Okay. Now, one thing I did want to bring up—not exactly feedback, and not necessarily for the show. Honky, has the New Year's show been posted yet?
It has. It got posted a while ago. It's just the only, by the time I got to posting it, the only days that were together in a row was in March. And you know what? I haven't looked at it in a while. So it is posted. It'll be coming very soon, I think.
Okay, excellent. I could have looked that up, but I thought we might mention it. Some folks might be interested. We're referring to the Hacker Public Radio New Year's Eve show, which is a 24-hour or more show we always do on New Year's Eve. And I did want to mention, I got a notice today that we were talking several shows ago about the SD card interface that you one end looked like an SD card, and then you had interfaces for two SD cards and a toggle switch. So in other words, you could set it up for dual booting without, just on a Pi or a microcomputer without needing to figure out how to put two different images on the same SD card. So apparently that's shipped today, and it's supposed to get here about the middle of April. So several shows from now, I'll let you know how that works out.
Real quick, episode one should air on, well, it should go out on the RSS feed on 3/14, HPR episode 2247.
Okay, great. Yeah, and I haven't really done much in the last 2 weeks. Was announced this week that they've succeeded the old Raspberry Pi Zero with the Raspberry Pi Zero W, with the W standing for Wi-Fi. And it's the same Wi-Fi and Bluetooth hardware that you would find on the Raspberry Pi 3. Going to be a little more expensive. Instead of $5, it's going to be $10. And that, my personal opinion on it is, well, I don't know, unless the project specifically called for it, and I still haven't tried my the built-in Wi-Fi on my Pi 3, so I probably shouldn't criticize unless I've tested it myself. But a lot of people said it doesn't work too well unless it's sitting right on top of the access point. But it's got Wi-Fi, and if that's something that would enhance your project, then probably you'd be excited about this. Me, if I were to, I had saw two of them in the store, I would probably still buy the original for $5 versus $10. But, and especially it'd be hoping there'd probably be some discounts out there on the originals now. But the way the Raspberry Pi Foundation usually works things, since there's a new model out, the previous model is probably very scarce in retail right now. Any other excitement for the Raspberry Pi of Wi-Fi or the Zero of Wi-Fi?
Well, just one quick one quick thought of I have limited experience with the Pi Zero, but are there still as many images for the Pi Zero as they are, let's say, for just the regular Pi?
I don't know. I think they're compatible.
I think they're compatible with like the Pi. They're compatible with the original. Are they compatible with the B? I think they might be compatible with the B. In which case, there would be a lot of images for that over. Now, I haven't looked at a Pi Zero. I'm sorry if I like noob questions. Is there a lot of GPIO pins on the Pi Zero?
Well, there's the same amount of GPIO connectors, but they are hole type connectors rather than pins, so there's nothing sticking up. So you could solder into those directly, or I assume you can probably get some kind of plug that'll go in there and have a ribbon cable on it or something.
It seems to me that with that many images and that much behind it, and if the if there's actually, what is K-Wisher saying in the there's no pins on the Pi Zero. I was gonna say if there was pins, then I would say that would, and depending on how good the Bluetooth and Wi-Fi are, I would say that would almost be a better product than the chip. But to best my knowledge, the Wi-Fi on the chip works pretty well, and it's pretty small. But it seems to me that you're pretty much limited to Debian, as opposed to the a Pi device where there's very little limitations to the amount of images out there.
Yeah, I'm sure probably can flash to a chip, but since it comes with Debian built in, I don't know very many people are opting to put on.
The pins are on the Pi Zero. There's just no header for it, so you have to. They do have a friction header you can hammer in, though.
Okay, with the chip, the best of my you can flash. Basically, you have to use. I think there's a couple ways to flash images on there, but you're limited to Debian with XFCE. I think it's XFCE. Either way, it's either Debian with a desktop or Debian without a desktop, and that's pretty much all you're given.
Your Pi Zero also, you really want to look into some of the Adafruit stuff, because they have a whole bunch of things designed to turn a Pi Zero into something much more powerful, and anything from joystick / game controllers, all sorts of stuff.
Well, it was kind of like what I was talking about last week, where I have the chip, and I was thinking about putting RetroArch on there so I can play games, because I was given the package with the HDMI and the little controller there, and it just doesn't seem to be worth it when I have other Pis sitting around, when all I gotta do is, you know, download RetroPie and DD that to a card, and I'm pretty much done, as opposed to having to put all the work into the chip.
Well, yeah, you got to remember these days the original Pi is pretty slow. I mean, Pi Zero is pretty slow because it uses the original Pi chip.
I should probably look at processor speed too and see what they would match up side by side.
How much memory on a chip?
Not much. I want to say it was, you know, I'm going to have to pull up the chip specs now.
I think 512.
That's what I was thinking too.
And so memory
size is a wash.
I'm looking at the download page on raspberrypi.org, and it doesn't show different images for different models. Okay, maybe not directly on that page. Probably if you click on one of the images, then it'll show you which models are supported.
All right, so the chip has Wi-Fi, BGN, it's got Bluetooth, It's got a 1 gigahertz processor, 4 gigs of storage built on, 512 of RAM, and that appears to be it. And then a bunch of GPIO pins.
Well, it does seem with the onboard storage, it's going to be fast.
That's fair. See, I was given the chip, like I said, that one package that had the HDMI and the little remote, and I was given also the dev kit, which comes with the chip that's soldered onto a board with a bunch of other attachments to it, and then the Chip Pro, I think, which is basically only thing that comes off of that is the micro USB for the power, and that's it. And you pretty much have to, like you said, about hammering on the thing for the pins. Like, you got to basically do that to it, or solder it. And I'm trying to figure out what I want to do with these things. Right now, I have the one with the HDMI hooked up to a monitor, and it's not a bad little desktop. It's not anything special, but it's not bad. But then some of the projects they have out there for these is like, how to use the chip to turn it into a Bluetooth speaker, how to use the chip to control little LED lights. I'm not sure what I want to do with this thing.
One thing I've known about the Pi Zero is, I believe, if you're willing to, that there's also a couple of holes where you can put an antenna connector on.
A little range to that Wi-Fi?
Well, since it's Wi-Fi range is considered abysmal. Whether it goes from zero range to one, you know, to plus something or other.
Yeah, I'm sure the fault's not so much in the chip hardware. Is it just you're going to get better performance with a whip type antenna than there's a difference in performance with the little Tweeno a USB Wi-Fi. Plug that's actually got an antenna on it versus the ones that are just the nubbin.
Where I see Pi Zero Wi-Fi working is when you want to put them, they have a board, a hat that allows you to put a bunch of Pi Zeros on the back of a Raspberry Pi as a host. Yep. If they're only trying to stock to the next board over or three boards over, they may have enough range for their own private network.
What would you use that for?
When you're doing Pi Zero supercomputing, you'd have a heck of a lot less cables to hook together.
Isn't that kind of an oxymoron?
Well, yes. You put four of them together, you have a 4-core, 2-gigabyte machine.
That's fair. But that's definitely not supercomputing. Though it's probably better than some of the machines I got sitting in front of me.
Well, eventually the Pi Zero will get its head out of its ass and get a real processor.
I'm always impressed when people do some of those. They take something like the SNES controllers, put the Pi Zero in it, and then have the line going from the Pi Zero from the controller to the television just be the HDMI. I always thought those were really cool projects. That and anytime anyone builds their own handheld system with, like, you know, a Raspberry Pi or the Pi Zero or whatever, because I'd love to be able to do something like that, but that's you basically need a like 3D printed equipment to be able to do that. You can't just build that on your own. You can't just buy the parts and do that on your own. You need like a 3D printed case to be able to do that.
Yeah, that's how comes most of the nice jobs are done with like the 7-inch screen where you put a regular Pi behind it.
I'd be happy with like a 5-inch screen. That's bigger than most of the handheld systems have been.
Well, then you're in luck, Honky. My next link, and this may have been around for a while. I might have seen it once before, but I don't recall. The Odroid W, which is probably about twice as wide as the Raspberry Pi Zero, with similar specs, But it's got a bunch of add-ons. The W in this case is not for Wi-Fi. They don't have onboard Wi-Fi on it yet, but is for wearable. It's made to be like a wearable device, and if you click on that page, they'll show you somebody wearing one on a wrist strap, because it does come with a battery, or can have a battery put connected to it, and about a 3x5 screen running full Linux.
Nice. I think to put anything together, you'd still need a 3D printer.
Yeah, I would think you'd have to, you know, to use it practically, you'd want some kind of case around this, instead of just the it must be plugging into the again the driven in GPIO headers. Yeah, I think if you wore this and you didn't surround it with a case, it would certainly fall apart on you at some point. But 700 megahertz ARM 11, so I think that's just about the same as what a Pi Zero is. And memory, the spec sheet, 4 gigabit, 512 megabyte. Okay, so the 4 gigabit must be speed, and the amount of memory is 512 meg. So it's pretty similar to the specs for the original Pi Zero.
Well, if it's meant to be meant for wearables, then 512 should be more than enough.
Right. I'm certain I must not have seen this before, because I don't already own one. I think if I'd seen this before, I'd already have done this.
Now, as a wearable, what would you build yours for? I know you had talked before about how you wanted something that you can keep track of, like IRC, while you're out working. What would you use? What would you build if it was build your own Odroid wearable?
Well, see, that's the question, you know, practicality. I mean, I'd probably build it just to wear around the conferences, show everybody how cool I am. But other than that, as far as interface, you know, I would think an on-screen keyboard would be an incredibly awkward to use. I guess you could always carry around a Bluetooth keyboard in your pocket.
Yeah, touchscreen on a 3x5 wouldn't be ideal, that's for sure, unless you had something set up with, like, an interface with nothing but large buttons, and that's really about it.
Yeah, and what they show running here just looks like stock LXDE.
That seems like it'd be harder to interface with.
This is something where, you know, stuff like Unity would probably at least be a better fit.
What would be a good desktop environment for something like that? There's got to be something out there that's just... Because you think about something like a wearable, or what desktop environment would be good for something like a wearable, or I've talked about or thought about in the past, like a car interface type of a thing, where all you want is... Even if you have a touchscreen, all you want is just like big buttons for those things that you use constantly. What type of Linux desktop environment would you use or try to configure for something like that?
Well, you might go back to the original one from the EEPC. You'd probably have to do some development and adjusting on your, so probably want something very configurable so you could make things really, really big.
Right.
It'd be nice if we had a good voice to text interface for Linux. I don't think there's anything that they have now that's foolproof.
Right.
I mean, I don't think you'd probably be able to say, you know, open a terminal, sudo apt-get update, you know, whatever. Though, if you had just specific things that you wanted to get into, you could certainly use
Blather. Blather.
Yeah, Blather.
Yeah, I was thinking about that while you were talking. Is that sounds like something that would work well with Blather.
And I wonder if you could incorporate the API for Ask Google, or that's not the right term, but you know, like this on the cell phone. Those APIs are available to other projects, like
Google.
Okay, Google. Yeah. I mean, they're using that on the back end of most of your open source Echo clones like Mycroft and etc. So that might solve that problem if you didn't mind everything you say going out to the NSA.
Now, do you funded the Mycroft project, right?
I did. I've yet to see hardware. I've mentioned here, and I'm not the only one that I've heard on a podcast say they're starting to get nervous that they're never going to deliver hardware, because the last couple emails I've gotten from them, they have emphasized all the new software they have available, all the applets, but not mentioned at all any progress on shipping hardware. And since they've released the image that you could build your own with a Raspberry Pi, minus all the facial animation things that were supposed to be controlled by an attached Arduino controller, I'm wondering if that's, I'm just afraid that, I'm glad the project's out there. There are other competing projects that we've talked about, and I've got a Raspberry Pi 3 here now. That's one of the things I want to experiment with, is try all of those and see what aspects that I like the best out of them.
It is definitely a very cool concept.
I mean, if one of those could be ported to the Odroid, maybe you could wear that around.
Yeah, I have a friend who has the Alexa, and I'm very unimpressed with Alexa, but Alexa's getting, the Amazon Echo is getting such a huge following right now that it's amazing. But it seems like Blather should be able to do most of the things that the Echo does, besides it's being able to obviously buy stuff from Amazon and maybe like some of its side stuff where it has games like Jeopardy and stuff set up into it. But it should be able to do, Blather should be able to do the voice commands to open up stuff and do stuff on I think Jezra who said he created it because he wanted to be able to walk into his house like he was on the Starship Enterprise and say play Iron Maiden and just have it play Iron Maiden when he walks in through the door or something along those lines.
Well, yeah, but the whole drawback of Blather is it's all pre-programmed commands. It does not actually can't actually translate English.
Right, but it's a way to like interact with your computer to be able to do things like have it play music. I think the one, what's his name, has done a lot of playing around with it. Who is it who's done all the HPRs around Blather? Jezra put the program Blather, but he's the one who's played with it the most.
Was it John Culp?
Yeah, it's definitely it's John Culp. Yeah, he's done a lot of work. Like he worked with something with working with Google, so he can do a text-to-speech to be able to write out a document through text-to-speech. I mean, was it speech-to-text? That one reversed.
Well, definitely if you had home automation set up and had those commands plugged in, it would be pretty cool.
I'd be happy if I could just walk up, sit down here at my computer and, turn on, screen on, open up a browser, search this and that. I'd be pretty happy with that. There we go. I just came up with an idea to use with my chip computer. Have it set up with speakers, and then have it set up for I can walk into the room and have it. I could start with speakers and a mic, so I can talk to it and have it tell it what I want it to play. Anyways, you had a 3D printer?
Yeah, this was another crowdfunding came up last summer or last spring. It's the 101 Hero, and it was touted as the world's cheapest 3D printer. And the base price was $50, but there was they had the consumer and the developer version, and on the Kickstarter only the developer version had a port for a USB cable so you could plug it into a computer. The default version, or the cheaper version it was supposed to be, you just put a file on an SD card and insert the SD card, and it'll print whatever's that on that one file. And I got mine and started since I didn't know this because I had the developer version, but I've seen reviews online. In fact, from the same person I have linked there in the show notes. He bought the consumer version, figuring, well, it's gonna cost them more to make two different versions than it would be just to give everybody the version with the USB port. And he was right. What he got was just the same as what I got, for $40 less. Or I mean, he paid 40. He didn't. I paid $40 more than he did, and we both got the same thing in the end. Now, a lot of the reviews I'm seeing, and mainly I have gone with those reviews. Let's see. Maker something on YouTube. Second, let me open the... Yeah, I'm opening the link. But he's done at least four. An unboxing one that was pretty long. And then three since then. I think the one that I've got on there is pretty much where he says, okay, I've got this thing working. It doesn't mean it's good. It's, you know, the stuff it prints is pretty rough. I'm going to be disappointed if I'm not able to accurately build a case or something like that. Yeah, the author is Maker's Muse, or the channel on YouTube is Maker's Muse. So I don't think when I bought this, there, unless I'm wrong, that there were those, say, ones in the $150-$170 range on Adafruit or AliExpress. I probably would have been a lot better off spending my money there, from what I've learned about this. On their website, they've, and I apologize, none of this part is necessarily Linux related, because certainly this is a cross-platform peripheral. But he made several modifications. Apparently the motors are about half as much power as you normally see. So it prints very, very slowly. The nozzle essentially is essentially just a 3D pin moving around. So it's different than your normal 3D printer. It doesn't look like the nozzle or anything is replaceable. A lot of non-standard stuff on this. And I haven't got to print anything yet. Now from these reviews, he was actually, when he was doing the review, the guy from Maker's Muse, he had chat open with other people who already had those, and they give you a couple short pieces, like 3 or 4 foot of the filament, one black and one white, and essentially the review, the people already had them were telling them in real time, no, don't even use that stuff. So since he had his deal is to review 3D printers and has at least two or three, he already had filament. So I ordered filament from Amazon. That's come. It said the tape to go, because you put tape on the tray. It's a glass tray to make it easier to separate the parts. And what they sent me was similar to masking tape. I guess there's some blue tape that everybody uses. And what the reviewer suggested was this sort of a glue stick thing that I've got coming, but I don't know how long that's going to take to get here. Looks like it'd be nice because it says it'll stick when the tray is heated and will release when the tray gets cold, but I don't have a heated tray. That's another thing. The Kickstarter says, oh yeah, you could use all this different plastic based on this one person. So now if you're using PLA without a heated tray or without a heated tray, PLA is the only thing you're going to be able to use. So, and I did try, I built my own file to go on the SD card to, that's supposed to take the thing back up to the top. Cause right now the point of the nozzle is actually below where the glass tray would be if I had it set in there. And the way they have that thing put in, they just give you these heavy duty, like document clips to hold it. You know, those things, a big black spring, and you have the levers that flip over, and you know, that's how they're attaching the glass tray to the plastic tray that it goes on top of. So, I don't know. I haven't even got it to move yet. The file I built that was supposed to return the thing to home doesn't seem to work. So I'm going to see if I can get it connected to Slicer software on the computer, how that'll go. And so that's the next part of the report is, you know, I've had the Odroid U2 sitting around for a while with plans. You know, I figured, well, when I get a 3D printer, that'll probably be a pretty good computer to use for control. And I'll get on that with a minute. But any more questions about the 3D printer itself, which I really haven't had much, still waiting on other accessories, and with much trepidation that it's going to be much good when I do have everything in line. Okay, the single board computer that I'm using connected to the printer is an Odroid U2, and this used to occupy the same price point as the X2 does now, which is the high performance Odroid. This used to be the high performance Odroid 3 or 4 years ago. Quad core processor, slightly older version of the video than what's the Raspberry Pi 3 has, but so it's 3 or 4 years old and about the same power as a modern Raspberry Pi 3 or an Odroid C2. And I just got this last summer on the secondary market through Ameridroid, and they were actually selling it for about the same price as a Raspberry Pi 3. And really the reason I bought it, if Amy wants to click on the link in the show notes, is it's just got that whole enclosure is a heat sink. And I've just thought that was, when I first saw that was one of the coolest things I'd ever seen, but I didn't want to pay like the $80 to get one. So when it came down to be affordable, I got that. Trouble is Odroids tend to be, there tends to be a lot of work on them right when they come out, and when they get a little long in the tooth, they get abandoned by the community. So if you also go to the link for the distributions, there's about 40 links, but if you look at them, they're all either Android or Ubuntu 14.04. So that 14.04 is the only link that goes on there, and it was just updates on both Android and the 14.04 to explain all the links. And unfortunately, I've been playing with it the last day. Well, as I say in the show notes, there doesn't seem to be a lot of Slicer software ported to the ARM processor yet. At least none that I can find in the repo. I'm not sure it works like this. I don't know if there would be more in a 16.04 repo. But I've been trying to do dist upgrade. And, well, it said it did dist upgrade. That was still on the same version. And then there's another upgrade command. It's like do dash revision dash update, I think what it is. I can look that up real quick, still the page open. And that complained that it hung on third-party software that was installed. And, of course, it's a fresh installation. So I went into software and updates on the menu and unchecked all of the non-external software, which was essentially the two browsers, Firefox and Chrome. And there's check boxes for a bunch of PPAs in there. So I unchecked all those, tried to run the update for the to get to a later later revision of the distribution from there, and it still gave me the same error. So that's something I'm going to have to figure out. Also, now there are couple places instructions for compiling Slicer on the Raspberry Pi, which should work just as well to compile it on the Odroid. But about halfway down through those instructions, I'm not going to read all those out because, yeah, if anybody wants to do that, they can just follow the instructions and do what I did. I just copy and paste each command into the terminal. But when I get down to sudo space dot slash build space install, it's telling me the build file's not there. So may have been some of the stuff that I selected in the previous Perl command, because I kept saying no, I don't. It asked if you want the simplest version without asking you a bunch of questions, and said yes. But if I should have answered anything differently, it should be here on this page. So I am going to compare this to other instruction sheets for compiling Slicer, and see where they differ, where the wheels come off. Or I'm going to actually have to, I did understand compiling a lot better back when I was doing it on Unix back in school. So I may need to just sit down and get back in that zone. So instead of just parroting commands from a page like this, I have a better understanding of what I'm actually doing. And the other option would be, at least I can try, since I've got a Raspberry Pi here free still, is to get the Octopi image for the Raspberry Pi 3, and just have a system with the Slicer software built in from install.
That might be at least the more maybe or maybe not. That might time wise for setup, that'll be a little bit faster. Compiling is not a difficult process in the general scheme of things. The problem is that you're going to be compiling on the Pi itself, will just take forever. You could look at a cross compiling, but that's when things start getting a little bit more complex.
Yeah, and it's sort of the white elephant that the U2 seems to be now. I'm not sure if I'd be able to find a cross compiler. Of course, if you look at the image, it uses the same image for about four versions of Odroid back in the day. So I think if you could find a cross compiler that worked with one, it'd work with all of them.
Yeah, I mean, cross compiling is basically using the same compiler. You just have the target the right machine code for the underpinning stuff. And I mean, if it compiles for ARM or whatever, then it should play just fine. So the fact that someone else already got it compiled on the device, I mean, that means that you can compile it. You can cross compile it. It's just for me, every time I've tried to set up cross compiling, it's been a pain in my ass because I didn't have to do it a whole lot. And so every time I'd have to go back and double check the documentation on how to do it and whatnot, and it was just annoying for me. So I tend to avoid cross compiling, but it does, if you're compiling something that's going to be run on other slower hardware, for instance, a mobile device or an ARM device, then cross compiling is kind of the way to go.
Okay, I think that's all I had for this week. Sorry for all the rambling.
Ain't no thing. I've got just a couple small things. One of them was actually shared on our Google Plus community page. It was shared by Honky, who was sharing from Joe Heck that RetroPie they need some legal help. They it turns out that they're based in the UK, and there is a US company that has apparently trademarked RetroPie as they've written it, and is sort of trying to enforce said trademark in various places, despite the fact that it could be argued that RetroPie has been operating under a mark, under that, at least that moniker, which the question is whether or not it qualifies as an actual trademark or a service mark, and that's when we get into legal things that are beyond me. So they're looking for help, and so we have a link in the show notes if anybody happens to know any intellectual property lawyers that they would appreciate some help there, I'm sure. They did get apparently a lot of good feedback they put a post on the 27th of February saying that they got a lot of feedback from folks, and they're responding to each of those emails, but I don't think that means that they're out of the water yet, and that the matter's settled and that they've got all the help they need. So I'd say if you know somebody or you are somebody, it's probably still worth it to reach out.
Yeah, a couple things I'd want to know about this. I don't know if prior art applies to trademark like it does to copyright. I guess not, because if you create a symbol for your company, then somebody else can come along and just trademark it.
It's a little bit more complicated than that. Prior art actually only really applies to patents, not so much to copyright. But the way trademarks work, trademarks do, in some ways, again, I'm not a lawyer, just intellectual property happens to be a fun hobby of mine. I don't have exciting hobbies, apparently. But the way trademark works, in on some ways, it's just like copyright, in that if you are, when you produce something that can be copyrighted, then you don't necessarily have to register it. Trademarks are the same way. You don't necessarily have to register a trademark. It's much easier to enforce if it is registered, and you have to actively defend your trade. Unlike copyright, trademarks you have to actively defend. So if you see somebody infringing on your trademark, you're obligated to send them a cease and desist so that you can show that you've been trying to enforce and maintain the purity of your brand, if you were. The complication with RetroPie, I'm not sure if they're, I have to look them up in terms of whether or not they're an actual organization. If it's just a package of software, it's harder to make the justification that they're an organization that's operating with a trademark. You know, that there's no trade for marking. It's just, you know, it's a piece of software, and that's where it gets into some kind of legal gray area.
And the other observation I would have is, as I understand it, the people who have, it's not somebody who is in a completely different sector of endeavor that just happened to fall upon the same name. These are people who are actually installing RetroPie on devices and then selling them using the RetroPie name. And this seems like shoot yourself in your own foot, because if they make it too difficult for the developer to continue, then they're not going to have a product to sell.
Well, again, it could be just from RetroPie is still just based on the program RetroArch, and they might be doing their own legwork of taking RetroArch and compiling their own course for it and putting it on a Pi.
Yeah, I think the real complication from a legal standpoint is the fact that RetroPie isn't, yeah, it's the name of a software package. It's not an organization per se. And that's again, that's where we get into a place where I don't have enough background to say that they have a clear case one way or the other. And it's what it comes down to though is just plain crappy. It's a shrewd mark by the U.S. company who has taken registered the RetroPie trademark. It's shrewd behavior, and you know, if it weren't nefarious, it would be kind of clever. But you know, it's one of those things where if RetroPie, the developers of RetroPie, get, you know, if they lose this legally, it's unfortunate. You know, it's losing by technicality.
And of course, probably their easiest path out of this is just to change the name.
True, but there's a lot of goodwill associated with it thus far. I mean, they've had a number of releases and you know, the name is fairly ubiquitous. And it's the thing is that even if they change the name, that wouldn't stop another company from trademarking their name, and still, you know, the reason why the name is in dispute, the reason why that U.S. company registered the mark is because it already has the goodwill, it already has the notoriety behind it. If the folks in RetroPie change their name, I mean, the community would definitely need to make a big push on like respecting the brand. That's happened before. I mean, you know, that's happened with that's happening now with Lineage. That happened with you know, LibreOffice. So it's not impossible. It's just it's a big shift, and if you can avoid doing it, it's preferable.
Now, I just want to point out that in the post, it says that that they may try to use the trademark against us. To the best of my knowledge, it doesn't seem like they have yet. It says, so the notice on the site says, RetroPie has been trademarked in the U.S. by a third party. They're using the trademark to issue takedown requests to retailers, including those who are just selling hardware listed as compatible with RetroPie. Meanwhile, they are selling RetroPie via their website and eBay. This is a risk that this person may try and use their trademark against us, too. So it seems like they haven't used their trademark against the RetroPie operating system, RetroPie, I don't call it an operating system, the RetroPie application? The RetroPie, what do we want to call them?
Package.
Thank you. RetroPie package that hasn't seemed to be used against them yet. We'd like to challenge the trademark. It was filed after we were using it, you know, after using the name, and they're using it to associate themselves with our software. If you are an attorney or think you could help, please drop us an email at retropieproject@gmail.com. So it seems like... go ahead. Sorry.
Wouldn't PyArch be the application? RetroPie is a distro.
RetroArch. And RetroPie is... I don't know, what would you call RetroPie? It's not... It's kind of like Kodi. It's not necessarily... It's a program. But it's a program that runs other programs. It's almost like...
It's a platform. That's the way I would classify it.
That's good classification. I like that.
Yeah, but you don't install RetroPie on, say, Raspbian. You can install...
You can?
Oh, okay.
You can install RetroArch on just about anything. Like I said, I was saying last week, you can install RetroArch on Android if you want to. And it's the same idea.
No, but I mean that was my point. You can RetroArch is an application and RetroPie is an ISO because you download it and flash an SD card and you know you boot it there. You know, it's RetroPie is the operating system, even though it's probably something else with RetroArch. I mean, I'm sure they didn't write their own version of Linux, probably. They probably started some.
It's a turnkey system is what you're talking about.
Right. Like I said, it's not unlike downloading Kodi or an OpenELEC dedicated to the Raspberry Pi, except for those applications don't seem to don't rename it as like Pi Kodi or something like that. This is the RetroPie is basically it's just Raspbian, except for it automatically starts into the RetroArch application, and it already has all of the cores for many different emulators already compiled and built on the system.
Yeah, I mean the to sort of simplify the situation in general. I mean, if you wanted to sort of doing an analogous thing in the general case, you have like you have this very kind old lady who bakes the world's best cookies, and everybody knows that I don't know what's come up with the name, Aunt Susie. Aunt Susie makes the world's best cookies and she's giving them away to everybody, and somebody decides that they are going to make their own cookies. They're going to call them Aunt Susie's cookies. They're actually taking Aunt Susie's cookies and reselling them, but they're also trying to go around and tell anybody else they can't sell Aunt Susie's cookies as Aunt Susie's cookies, even though she's still giving away those cookies for free. That's basically what the situation is.
Well done, sir. But they seem to be worried that that they're going to try to take go after them, and that's what they're looking for help for.
Right. And well, it's also, you know, if you don't want somebody else to, if everybody else, you know, there are people who are putting, you know, RetroPie on hardware and selling it. And if, which is perfectly legal and perfectly fine. And that's fine. Selling it on eBay. They don't want one bad actor to corner the market on that, to prevent anybody else. You know, it's basically, it's sort of peeing in the pool, right? It's just not cool behavior. So if they can challenge the trademark and win against it, that prevents somebody from acting in poor faith with the general community. But I'll shuffle on to the next little thing here, which is also good news. Cloudbleed. Have you guys been following any of the Cloudbleed stuff with what happened with Cloudflare and the parser bug that they ran into?
Nope.
Oh, goody. Well, here's a little background. So, Cloudflare is a CDN service. CDN is a content delivery network. For anybody who's not familiar with it, the way content delivery networks work, you know, you want to go to a website, you put the URL in. In the simplest case of it, your computer bounces through a bunch of other computers until it gets to the server that has the web pages you're looking for, and then that server delivers those pages back to you over the magic that is the interwebernets. And the problem is if that server is geographically far from you, it might take a long time, it might take a lot of bounces before that data gets to you. So CDNs, the content delivery networks, were developed to sort of be geographic caches, right? So you, if you're based in, I don't know, we'll say New York, and the server is in China, you know, you might see a large number of bounces before you actually get response to that, especially since the Great Firewall and all that stuff's involved. But let's sort of disregard that for a moment. So what a CDN does, it will cache, you know, that content and try and keep it up to date, and so that you don't have to get from a server in China, you can get whatever the cache is that's closest to you, that might be, you know, in Philadelphia. And that generally makes being on the web a much more pleasant experience. And Cloudflare offers that service, and they actually offer it for free for a lot of places. So a lot of people use Cloudflare. Well, Cloudflare had a bit of a bug that was exploited that was not unlike Heartbleed, actually. And a lot of information that should have been either encrypted or private or not for public viewing, like passwords, credentials, and or, you know, apparently I think this was discovered as somebody seeing private messages on a dating site. There's a Google researcher who stumbled across this, and that's a bad thing. So they fixed the bug within a couple hours, but by then the damage is done. I have a link in the show notes to a list of all the sites that have been potentially affected by this. It's a gigantic list, so it's in your best interest to change your passwords.
Do you know which dating sites?
It's in the article that I actually, there's an Ars Technica article. Let me put that in the show notes as well. Give me 1 second. Looks like, according to Ars Technica, it was OkCupid.
A dating site named OkCupid?
Apparently. Yeah, I've added that to the show notes as well. It's a pretty serious thing. So because Cloudflare offers that service for free, a lot of people use it. Hell, I use Cloudflare on a number of my sites, and if you're on the internet, you should probably change your passwords. This got me actually launched on a whole half hour tirade on my own podcast about passwords and backups and that kind of thing, encryption and security. So yeah, it's serious stuff.
Do you use a password manager?
Absolutely. It took me a long time to convince myself that I should, but once I did, I'm not going back to anything else. I'm using a KeePass or KeePass X actually on my desktop.
Not sure if I could use a password manager. I think I need to do better at making passwords. I think there was a Hacker Public Radio that came out a while back. I don't remember who did it, but about keeping a card in your wallet with your passwords in it, but it's the way that the card is set up. Only you kind of understand which one is the password, which it's basically just a giant list of a bunch of stuff. And only you can kind of decipher where in that line things start and where in that line things are actually the passwords. Man, I really wish I could remember the name of that now.
I think that was a hookah or who did that? I can't off the top of my head remember, but I remember that as well.
It was either a hookah or John Culp, wasn't it?
Yeah, it could be. I mean, with the number of episodes that each of those have made, it's
that's true.
It's, you're a fairly good bet to think it's either one of them. But I believe it was a hookah. But the having a password manager just for generating, you know, 30 character passwords and not using the same password anywhere but once has been a big benefit to me. I'm a big fan of that. I had my own password boondoggle last week, I believe, where this is not related to any of this necessarily, in that I thought I'd corrupted the crypto headers on my laptop because I have full disk encryption, and it turns out that I was just mistyping the passphrase because I was trying to remember the exact characters in the passphrase and not relying on muscle memory just to type it, because I forget my passwords. I just let my hands remember them.
Yeah, I've had that problem for a long time. I have to use a, not a password, but a punch-in for logging in to, punching into work. I have to use a five-digit passcode or whatever to punch in. And then you have, like, I've had times when I've walked in and I can't mentally think of it, but my hand just kind of does it on its own. Same thing with like pins sometimes, where I don't remember what the hell the pin is for my debit card, but my finger knows the way, so that I'll just let my finger do the walking.
Yeah, I think I've convinced myself that I'm gonna have to. I've already made a a key file that I'll store on a USB thumb drive or whatever that I can, in case my muscle memory fails me, or I start overthinking again, or you know, I randomly lose my hands. having some form of a second way of entry that doesn't rely on my memory is probably smart.
So I saw a project that was, I think it was like a Pi Zero project where they had like a 3.5. Basically, they built something that looked like an MP3 player that's supposed to be plugged into a laptop. And then it's supposed to be read as like, when you plug it into a laptop, it's supposed to be thought of as like a second, as a external keyboard. And then you can scroll through there to be able to put in your password. So it's supposed to look like an MP3 player, but it'd be like a password, like a thing that's supposed to store all your passwords that you kind of carry along with you. I thought that was a kind of cool project, but at the same time, that would, you know, if somebody got a hold of that, then you'd kind of be screwed.
Yeah, I remember something about that, but I can't remember what it was called.
No, but it looked like an interesting project. But again, it looked like something that I would need to find either buy to set up a 3D printer or know somebody with a 3D printer to be able to get that put together.
Well, I believe we all know somebody with a 3D printer now, don't we?
I think we know at least two. We have Mr. 5150 once he gets his put together. Taj, if he is an avid 3D printer, I think he himself is not a printer, but he has built his own 3D printer and is very astute in the 3D printing arts. I don't think there's a good way to say that.
He make good 3D printing things. That's I'll just eschew all eloquence and just go with that. But right. Yeah, I mean, there's always Make XYZ, which I've used in the past to do 3D printing, and that's a pretty useful setup.
Now, is that where you basically get somebody to print something from like Thingiverse for you?
Or you send them your own STL, and they'll slice and print it for you. And I mean, I don't think anybody with 3D printer with a 3D printer makes a whole lot of loot off of doing that, which is why I think it's dropped off in popularity on that front. But as somebody who needs something 3D printed and doesn't have a 3D printer, Make XYZ is not a bad choice. Also, Shapeways would be a good choice, I think. Shall we sally forth to your topics there, Honky?
Sure.
Yeah, I want to hear about this wallpaper.
Wallpaper? Did I misspell something? Oh, the last one.
No, all three. All of them.
All of them, yeah. Jeez, good Lord. English. Yay. All right. Wallpaper. I've talked about it before, but Architect Linux. Architect Linux is it's an ncurses program that runs a bunch of like scripts to basically install a it's basically the easiest way that you can install Arch. Just a blank, just a clean Arch install. It's an excellent it's an excellent piece of software. Anyone who wants to play with Arch and doesn't want to do something like a Manjaro or Antigros, Architect is the way to go. So I used I don't remember whether it was on the show or just an IRC that I was complaining about the fact of trying to get Thunar with the packages to be able to do Samba and other types of thing with Thunar, the plugins for it, and how I just was having no luck with just stock Debian trying to get those installed. But I remember in the past, anytime I've used Arch, that's all it was. Like when you install some programs with Arch, like Thunar, it goes, well, we, you know, you could also install this, this, and this, like X Archive and other programs that work really well with Thunar. And one of them was the plugin for that. And it's, you know, stock in the repos, as opposed to other things where it's like a PPA. But so I decided I was going to go with one of my laptops. I was going to go with stock Arch. So I tried I put Architect back on. I tried Architect again. Put it on my little laptop. I have a little laptop that I've decided is going to be like my free range laptop. It is a little 10-inch screen. It's a nice tiny compact. I just bought a new battery for it. The old battery gave me battery life of about like an hour. This one's giving me battery life of, I haven't pushed it to its limit yet. So more than an hour though. Let's put it that way. So I used Architect, which is a beautiful thing. Just kind of walks you through step by step. I usually use something else to do the partitioning because I find Ncurse's partitioning partition programs is a bit of a pain in the butt. While Gpart is such a beautiful thing, and all you need is a live distro, which most things are a live distro nowadays. Just get a live distro with Gpart already installed on it, and use that to partition the hard drive, and then start Architect, and it'll walk you through everything from like what type of desktop environment, what type of window manager, what type of additional software, like not like the very basics. So when you're done with Architect, you're done. You basically have a blank Arch system. Now, one of the things that kind of bothered me was the fact that wireless drivers. The B4.3, you need the B4.3 FW cutter for some wireless drivers. And this one, this laptop apparently needed the B4.3 FW classic wireless driver driver. And apparently that's only available in the AUR. So I actually had to come down here and plug it straight in to be able to go through the whole install. And then I got the full install with my Enlightenment desktop, which Enlightenment's on at 21 now. That's pretty cool. Most things, you know, most of the time when you install Enlightenment, like if you install Enlightenment on Debian right now, it's still 17, but they're up to 21 now. That's a lie. So I needed to install the B4.3 classic FW cutter from the AUR, and to be able to get that, I got we have talked here in the past actually about how Yart seems to be going downhill. Actually, I think it was last week or the week before we talked about how Yart seems to be going away, and so I found PACAUR. Now, which one did you say you were using right now?
That's the one. Packer.
So apparently to get this installed, there is on GitHub, there is basically a bash script to get it installed. And so I just pretty much did a copy and paste of that bash script and ran it, and it worked beautifully. I put a link to that bash script in the show notes in case anybody wants to use it. So here I have a nice fresh Arch system. I got my wireless working, but anyone who's ever seen a base Arch system with nothing is just, it's bland. It is so freaking bland, especially Enlightenment. Enlightenment never gives you like any like stock wallpapers. So I need to spice this thing up a little bit. So first thing that came to mind was wallpaper, wallpaper, wallpaper. The easiest one, obviously, was Enlightenment, because all you got to do is basically right-click on the screen. Well, not right-click. You just got to click on the screen, go to settings, go to wallpaper, And if you have something installed or whatever, like an image, all you have to do is pick that image, set it up, and you're good. So you have a wallpaper on your desktop. But when you start up the system, you're still going to, like, I chose LightDM as my desktop manager. And it's kind of depressing because if you do anything like Debian or anything else that has the desktop manager, there's some sort of wallpaper there. I have a blank screen with this big old box. So I figured, what the heck? I am going to install a wallpaper on LightDM. So to install a wallpaper on LightDM, it's real, real easy. All you have to do is open up the config file, which is /etc/lightdm/lightdm-gtk-greeter.conf, which I think there's a different one if you're using KDE. I'm not 100%. I'll check with the I have a link to the Arch Wiki. There might be a different one for like a KDE. Now, there is also GUI programs involved with this, but I just went with the straight up editing the conf file. So inside of the conf file, there's a section in there defined as the background and the section called greeter. So basically just uncomment that out and find yourself a nice JPEG or PNG file. They recommend that you put it in the /user/share/pixmaps file. Put it into there, put it in the section under background, and it basically restart it, and you have a wallpaper. It's very simple, it's very easy, but when you're if you're sitting there staring at a blank screen every single time you start up, it's really nice. So I figured I'd push it one step further. I wanted to put a wallpaper on Grub. So to do that, you have to edit the /etc/default/grub file, uncomment the section that says has /grub_background, and then it's /boot/grub, and then the image that it says my image, but I think that would be the link to the image that you want to put in there. What the heck did I do there? Now I got to look at that. Either way, uncomment that out and put in the link to your image in there. And then you need to regenerate your grub file by doing sudo grub-mkconfig-o, then /boot/grub/grub.cfg, and it'll say that it found the image. But you have to remember that when you're setting up an image for Grub, it needs to be a lower resolution image. The one I have set up right now is something that I kind of put together myself like a while ago. I had taken, so anybody who has seen me on G+ or anywhere else, I have my own little icon set up that's a tux with a Viking outfit on, with the Minnesota Vikings, a football team logo on his belt. I kind of recolored in some spots, but I had at one point downloaded a bunch of, I think I went through Google and searched Viking tux images, and I had downloaded a bunch of Viking tux images, and I had put them all together, and I had them all, like, the image I put together was just all of them in a row looking at the one final one that I had kind of created for myself at the end there. Anyways, it was a low-res image, and that's what I wound up setting up as my my Grub menu image. Like, at some point I might create something that's a little bit better looking than that, but in the meantime I got that set up, and now my default Arch install is a little less bland looking.
Now, does having a background in Grub slow down the boot at all?
Nope, not at all.
Nice.
And it's not necessary at all, but you know what, it's kind of fun.
And you're still able to access the Grub menu.
Correct.
By the way, what version of Linux does Architect install?
Whatever's current in Arch, as far as I know.
Yeah, exactly. All it is it's basically a shell script that pulls down like whatever the latest version of Arch is.
Now, one warning. I checked their SourceForge site, and the link to the homepage doesn't work. So this may be an abandoned project.
Maybe, but all it is basically a bunch of bash scripts, and it's all just set up on SourceForge, and you can download from SourceForge the 32-bit and 64-bit version of it, and it's what I ran, and I have a completely updated version of Arch, so I think it's basically something that they set up, and you know, where do they go from there? So they just kind of stopped. But I've never seen a homepage for it. I just downloaded it off of SourceForge. Okay, so when in grub, you would do uncomment the other section that was grub underscore background, and then you just put in where the image is. What the hell am I thinking of? Whatever, like mine would be slash home slash fill slash pictures slash Vikings underscore wall dot JPG. So it's just
the path.
That's it. Thank you. The path to that image. That's all you have to do. And then, like I said, you have to run that command to it redoes the grub that's CFG file, and then you're pretty much good. But it has to be a low res image. Because this one is the only one that I have that works, really. I tried one of the other pictures I have, and it doesn't work too well. I wonder if I can just take one of those images and see if I can kind of knock it down a few pegs and if it'll work.
Well, I'm sure there's a spec somewhere for that.
I'm sure there is. But there's other things in here, too. Like, when I did that, I also uncommented out the menu colors. Like, right now, I have the grub color to be light dash blue with slash black, and the grub color highlighted will be light slash cyan slash blue. It looks really nice. Apparently there are themes too, so you can do in the section grub underscore theme, you can do path to GFX GFX theme. I don't know. I haven't looked into that too much. I just kind of wanted to put a wallpaper on there. Like I said, when you have anybody who has seen a blank Arch install, it's just a whole lot of nothing. So I just wanted to kind of color it up a little bit. And then I just kind of went all the way and even colored up grub.
Yeah, I'm actually still not, except for the Surface Pro, I actually still boot into a TTY and StartX from StartX. I don't use a desktop, a DM, which I probably ought to on my workstations. I just haven't. By the way, it looks like, at least according to some older documentation, the required size or the proper size for a grub splash image should be 640 by 480. Good old 640 by 480.
All right, so maybe I'll just take a different image and then change it to use GIMP to resize it to 640 by 480 and then give that a shot.
You may also want to try 800 by 480 if you have a 16:9 widescreen aspect.
Good to know.
Put a link in the Mumble chat to or just pick that up.
Yeah, I have a nice little wallpaper with Yoda holding a book that says grammar with a green background that might look pretty cool as a grub splash screen.
Nice. Well, cool. Does anybody else have anything else they want to toss in before we shut it down for the night? Well, I think that settles it then. So our next recording date, the next time we're having an episode, a meeting, if you will, is March 17th, 2017. The music for our show is Downright, provided by Klaatu and Brome. Thanks to Tony Bemis from the Sunday Morning Linux Review for our web hosting, WordPress support, and email list server. We also want to thank Delwyn for providing the Mumble server we use and creating a bot module to find the next show recording date. Just type .ns in our IRC channel, which, by the way, again, is Linux Lugcast on Freenode. I am still Fweeb. We also have 5150.
See you later, folks.
Honky Magoo.
Good night, folks. It isn't March 17th, St. Patrick's Day.
It is the last time I checked, so yeah. And Netminer.
Okay, folks, time to reawaken your green screens.
Good night.
Take care. By the way, I found an operating system for Tejo.
What do you got?
Cubes.
Now, didn't we bring up cubes? Or somebody bring up cubes? Actually, did you bring up cubes before?
I don't know. I was talking Proxmox. Instead of KVM, it uses Xen, but it seems to do most of what he wants, except support Windows.
I think just take the time and effort to build a like a stock Arch system, because the stock Arch system, you're given like next to nothing, and that's what he wants, is just a bare-bones system. And basically, everything's already, there's nothing with an open port, because everything's closed by default, and then if all he wants to do is run VMs, then all you have to do is install the few packages you actually want, and boom, you're done, I think.
Well, the thing is that Cubes is designed to manage each application in a VM sandbox. So you can have a browser that's just for banking that's completely isolated from everything else. Because that's what that VM does. It has the built-in application. It has built-in application VM isolation with a management VM on top.
Which is handy.
Yeah, I'm thinking of building my bigger machines will be running VirtualBox, but my smaller machine, I may try to run KVM. I get the impression KVM is a lighter weight package.
I'm going to be honest. I really don't have any idea. I have very limited experience when it comes to running VMs. I have all really old hardware that really just, it's not worth trying to run a VM in it.
Well, I've got aging hardware at the moment, but my 64-bit stuff, I've maxed out to 16 gigs of memory just so that I have space for VMs on board. Speaking of space, I've decided to pick up one or maybe two 1650 by 1080 monitors to go with my 1600 by 900 laptops.
Nice.
Well, the idea is to put on those screens the toolbars and whatnot, and sort of the dashboard, so that I can fill the edges with that stuff and still save 1600 by 900 as a image size on the bare desk. They're a 16 by 10 instead of a 16 by 9 screen.
Nice.
Also, I can get them in Micro Center for like $80. By the way, what do you think of the Tinker board?
The what?
Asus Pi Killer.
I don't know. I really haven't looked at it.
Well, it uses an ARM A53 32-bit processor running at 1.8 gig quad core, 2 gigs of RAM, genuine, I think it's genuine gigabit NIC, although I haven't seen any speed tests to tell whether they can actually drive it full speed.
Cool.
It's built to drop into a Pi case, although you may need a bigger power supply. It may have been what most people were expecting the Pi 4 to be.
Now, they announced anything about a Pi 4 yet?
Actually, they haven't, but I think their answer was the Pi Zero W.
Good evening, Fweeb.
Hey, hey.
Welcome to the party.
It sounds eventful.
It is.
What is OctoPrint?
To the best of my knowledge, it is a program that is used with a 3D printer. What exactly it does, or how exactly it's connected to it, I'm not exactly sure. But I just, anytime I've heard of OctoPrint, I believe it is in, usually with people talking about 3D printers. I'm not sure if it's what you would connect up to a 3D printer that the 3D printer can talks to. But they also talk about using it for, like, they'll connect a camera up to it so they can keep an eye on the 3D print. So I'm not sure if... I don't know. Like I said, I've only heard it talked with 3D printing.
Yeah, I got a kick out of the fellow I was talking with who's a gamer. He says, by the time you need to upgrade a machine, you should just buy a new machine.
I could understand that if you're gaming.
Well, I was talking about upgrading my machines with an eSATA SSD and USB 3 out of the express card slot. He thinks express card is out of the dark ages like parallel ports. To say that he was perhaps terminally young is a definite possibility. His event horizon was definitely very close.
Hey, Anki, did you want to bring up the RetroPie call for help thing?
Yeah, I believe we should probably bring it up. I don't have that brought up anywhere. I'm working on. I have like no preparation. I have an actual topic to kind of talk about, and I have no preparation, so I'm trying to get that all worked out here. But yeah, that's definitely something we should talk about, I think.
Well, I'm actually on all three of our channels. I'm on Mumble, looking at the show notes and links from the show notes, and I actually have IRC going.
Wow! Who are you in IRC? Are you a netminer in IRC?
I believe so.
Fifty, you there? Hello, 5150. Your lips lighting up, but I can't hear you, bud. All right, so does anybody here use Chrome or Chromium?
I periodically open up Chromium.
So I've been having an issue lately, and I thought it was just with one machine, but I think I've noticed the same thing on another machine. Every time I hit back, it just kind of really lags out. Like, the screen flashes a couple of times, and then, like, after, like, a good solid minute, it finally goes back.
That seems strange.
It does seem strange. And I, like I said, I was pretty sure it was just the one machine, but I tried it on another machine, and I thought I saw the same problem happening. So I'm very confused.
Yeah, I've not ever encountered that.
See, the one reason why I stuck with Chrome or Chromium is I really, really enjoy the fact that every time I install a system and reinstall it and log into it, I automatically get the exact same setup and all the tabs and everything I had before. And it might be the same with Firefox. I just haven't played around with Firefox enough to be able to get that. 50, any luck?
Yeah, I'm here now, guys. Sorry. Poor time management this evening on my part. I left an errand too late that it needed to be done. I should have done it earlier in the day.
Oh, that's fine. It looked like you were having audio issues. That's what I was concerned about. Well, like, we don't start late.
No, it's just I was on the phone on my drive home, and I guess I'd never set Plumble in there to push the talk, and I said I had push the talk working, but I guess you guys still couldn't hear me.
All right. I don't remember seeing any feedback. Does anybody remember any feedback?
There was Kevin Wisher's link to embedding Google Docs sheets in a WordPress, I think. And then aside from that, it's been pretty quiet. I think there was more PackPress stuff being pushed on our Guji Plus page. But aside from that and the RetroPie thing, I think that's about it. Oh, I also stumbled across that the Bitscope blades. But that's not really feedback and not really much to talk about since I don't think anyone actually got one yet.
What is it?
It's a way of essentially clustering Raspberry Pis.
Oh, right. I remember seeing that.
Well, since their younger mounts start with either one or two Pi mounts, clustering is a little strong. It's more of a powering system. And you don't have to go to a full blade.
Yeah, the wall mount thing was probably the most appealing component of that. The sort of heavy processing I do, I don't think a Pi is going to hold up to the kind of things I would toss at it.
The question is, if they can they handle the requirements of a Tinker board.
All right, it's getting late enough. What do we think? Who wants to be the host? Anyone? Anyone?
I haven't stumbled through the intro in a while.
Okay. Now, I'm going to throw this one out there. I think I've mentioned it before, but I figured I'll just mention it again to the people in the room and people listening. I have basically gotten lazy to the point where I start the recording before the show, and once the show is ended, I stop the recording. So I used to have a recording, well, one that was basically the unedited version, which I started before the show and then ended at the end of the show or sometime after the end of the show. And then I had the one I called the show that I started right at the beginning, right before we started the intro and then ended right at the end. I've kind of stopped doing that because, in my opinion, there's a lot of good conversation that happens beforehand and sometimes afterwards, but I figured we usually end late enough lately that we just kind of, by the time we're over, we're kind of over. So I usually stop it right at the end, and I don't bother doing any post-editing. Like, it would probably be good to do, like, tilts and take that whole beginning part where we have our conversation and tack it on to the end. But I haven't been doing that, so I was wondering what people's opinions are of that. People listening, if they want to throw in their two cents, and people in the room right now, what their opinions are. And people who are listening in on the stream who can communicate through IRC. So I think that's just Kevin, but...
Me personally, I kind of like an intro opening the show with the actual intro, so tossing the chatter to the end of it sounds like it might be the ideal option. But I'm, you know, I can go either which way.
You're gonna make me work, aren't you?
You don't have to do what I say. I'm just saying what I would, you know, where my appeal is on this.
Yeah, I hate to make extra work for you.
That means I'm probably gonna have to rework the script now too. I wonder if I could set that up where I take notes somewhere when we actually started the show in the recording that I have, and then I can use, I can edit, have it, part, have the script, somewhere in the script do the editing for me, and tack it on the end. Of course, that would probably still require me to do a good listen afterwards to make sure that that got done right.
It is possible.
It is possible.
You could put a timestamp in the show notes. It's just remembering to do that.
What I do is, the way I have the script set up right now is when I start the script, it actually asks a few questions. It asks me which file that I want to use, I want to use. So no matter what it's called at that time, it'll get renamed later on. But like, there are times when you had given me the file and you had labeled it as like LLC 71, so I'll I'll run the script. The first line of the script is it'll ask me which file do I want to use. So I'll type. I'll put in LLC71 .wav. But when I do it, I usually put it in as logcast _71 .wav. So I'll put that in. I'll have it ask me what the show number is. So that gets added into the script with the whole naming of things. And then it asks me what were some of the show topics. So I'll plug in what some of the show topics are, and that gets added on later on when I use Dave Morris's script for the audio tags. So on the audio tags, it'll have what some of the topics were for the show. Which, by the way, I want to give a huge shout out to Dave Morris. Dave Morris actually took the time and effort and found a way to compile all of his Perl script into one. Everything for that Perl script is in one file now. So I was able to download this one file and run it, and without having to go and download all of the other Perl dependencies and stuff, it will just run. I gotta find the email so I can talk more about what he did. But that thing it's compiled together in like an executable file, but it just runs like a Bash script. It's awesome.
Yeah, you get that forward a copy to me because one of the things that I was installing depended on a whole bunch of additional Perl dependencies, and I was having trouble getting them all in there.
All right, maybe go ahead and read this thing.
Sure.
Cool. Mark the time.
SMLR 2.0 is the revamped Sunday Morning Linux Review with Tony Bemis, Mary Tomich, and Tom Lawrence. On even episodes, we cover distro fever and tech news. On the odd episodes will be fresh looks where we review a distro or software or tips and tricks. Live recordings are bi-weekly. Sunday morning on both Google Hangouts on air and audio only stream. Visit smlr.us for all the shows and the live recording schedule.
The Linux Link Tech Show. Tune in to the world's longest running Linux podcast live every Wednesday, 8:30 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time. Find us on the web at www.twlts.org. Or email us at techshow@thelinuxlink.net. IRC server, thelinuxlink.net /techshow. Join Pat, Alan, Link, and Joel. And don't forget the two Dans. They are so hot. I know, because I've kissed them both. And Blindridge, he's a bloody drunk. If you don't like the gas, you can get up your ass.
Ain't no funny duddies that'll link it back. G'day, my name's Jude, or better known as Mrs. 64. Hacker Public Radio needs your help. They're running out of shows. If you ever thought you'd like to contribute or do a podcast yourself, here's your chance. Come on, Hacker Public Radio needs you. If you think you're going to sound silly or not going to sound like you know what you're doing, think again, because it never seems to stop my husband. It's easy, and if you live in the USA or the UK, it's as simple as picking up the telephone and phoning the call-in number to record a show, or plugging in a mic and opening Audacity. Get over to hackerpublicradio.org/contribute.php.